reporting live from the Republican National Convention in Philadelphia. First, a Democracy Now! Encounter with former President Bush. Then analysis on General Colin Powell as he takes center stage. We'll have commentary from the Socialist Party candidate for president, Dave McReynolds, and some of the activists behind the ruckus this week. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez, and we're reporting live from the Independent Media Center in downtown Philadelphia, just a mile away from the Republican National Convention at First Union Convention Center. A few thousand protesters led by people in wheelchairs marched on the Republican National Convention yesterday to demand economic rights for people oppressed by poverty and homelessness. The opening of the four-day convention that will nominate Texas Governor George Bush for president also brought the first of what are expected to be days of arrests when nine people blocked a downtown intersection to put a grim political skit on attacking U.S. military involvement in Latin America. Yesterday's main event was a peaceful march for economic human rights that drew more than 5,000 people to downtown Philadelphia at midday. They marched to show the face of poor people to the delegates of the Republican convention, one in five who are estimated to be millionaires.
Meanwhile, gay Republican activists say Texas Governor George W. Bush's outreach effort and the primetime convention speech of an openly gay Arizona Congressman Jim Colby could help the GOP alter its image as hostile to gays and lesbians. Also, the party's expected embrace of former Defense Secretary Dick Cheney's openly lesbian daughter could help convince voters that Bush's compassionate conservatism is genuine. The daughters of Bush's vice presidential pick arrived here with their parents Sunday. A close friend said that Mary Cheney, 31, will have a role beyond the convention and will be constantly at her father's side during the campaign trips. Still, the GOP faces staunch opposition to progress on gay issues from its far right wing. This faction restored to the party's platform anti-gay language that Bush had removed. Over the weekend, one of the right's best known voices, the Reverend Jerry Falwell, created a minor furor by calling Cheney's daughter errant in his newsletter.
Iowa Senator Tom Harkin, one of Al Gore's possible vice presidential running mates, helped lead a Democratic attack yesterday against the Republican ticket of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. With the Republican National Convention yesterday night touting the theme, Leave No Child Behind, Harkin charged Bush and Cheney have both turned their backs on poor children. Senator Harkin said, this Texaco ticket hears oil companies loud and clear, but when it comes to kids who can't get a fair start to life, they simply smile and nod and do nothing. Harkin is believed to be one of about a half a dozen people still under consideration by Gore as a possible Democratic vice presidential running mate.
And in other news, Canada's second largest private television network said today that it would buy about half of the country's larger daily newspapers from Conrad Black, the international press magnate. In the largest media deal in Canadian history, Canwest Global Communications is to pay $2.36 billion for the dominant dailies in eight of Canada's 10 provinces. Quote, the borders are gone, we have to grow, said Mr. Asper, Global's chairman, at a news conference in Toronto yesterday, comparing his acquisition to Tribune Media's recent purchase of the Los Angeles Times. He went on to say, we don't intend to be one of the corpses lying by the information highway.
More Swiss firms came forward yesterday to say they might have used forced labor during World War II, and the government said new names had been unearthed of refugees from Nazis turned back at the border. Swiss companies and public authorities have until August 25th to hand over data on forced labor and on rejected refugees in order to be included in a U.S. compensation settlement for victims and shielded from future litigation. A list is currently being drawn up for distribution of $1.3 billion paid into a fund by Swiss banks and insurers. That's some of the news at this hour.
There's a river in my dreams, flowing endlessly to you. There's a river in my dreams, there's a river in my dreams.
There is no place where I can go without you here close to my heart.
There's a river in my
when
dreams,
I close my eyes, I see.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, broadcasting live from Philadelphia for the Republican National Convention. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez in this, again, day two of a historic collaboration between community television and community radio. We are broadcasting on community radio stations around the country. We are being audio streamed and video streamed on the web at www.democracynow.org and freespeech.org. We are being broadcast on television through Free Speech Channel on Dish Network, channel 9415, and also on public access channels on cable stations around the country. Unprecedented, Juan.
Yes, and a challenge to much of the other coverage that where all of the corporate media seem bored by events, we are managing to find quite a bit to report about in this week, and a lot of stuff that is not getting into much of the other coverage.
That's right. Well, last night, Juan, on the first night of the Republican National Convention, if you just looked at the stage, you would have thought you were at a black church. You would have thought that you were in a downtown area where the majority of the population were people of color. But in fact, that's not what the people on the convention floor look like. An AP poll has been done. 83% at least of the delegates are white, 4% African American, 3% Latino, and others did not identify themselves, I believe 1% Asian.
Well, you would expect that from the Republican Party because it's their show. But one of the amazing things to me, how even again the media fell into propagating the same image that the party was trying to project from the platform as Colin Powell was speaking on television, I'd say every other face that they went to in the crowd seemed to be African American and Latino, which was a total distortion by the reporters of the who was in the audience and listening to the speech.
That's right. And the reason I say black church is because there was a good deal of gospel music last night.
But the most amazing given General Powell's speech about inclusion, the Republican Party should head in the direction of more inclusion. There's an amazing op-ed piece in today's New York Times by Faye Anderson, an African-American Republican who was the former vice chair of the Republican National Committee and who resigned recently in protest of the party's policies. And I'm just going to quote a couple of sentences from her op-ed today. She says, in Philadelphia this week, the Republican Party faithful will play their parts as master illusionists trying to convince independent voters that this is a different kind of convention for a different kind of Republican, George W. Bush. And she goes on to say that she was forced to resign from the party recently because of the history of the party. She says, the proximate causes of my resignation from the GOP's Minority Outreach Committee were Mr. Bush's appearance at Bob Jones University, his unwillingness to condemn the flying of the Confederate flag atop the South Carolina State House, But my resignation, she says, was 2 years in the making. It was set in motion by a pattern of blunders that included the Republican National Committee's gala at the ancestral home of Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, the House Republicans' refusal to support a resolution condemning the Council of Conservative Citizens, a white supremacist group that had been given open access to GOP leaders like Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott, and Louisiana Governor Mike Foster's reported payment of $150,000 for David Duke's mailing list of supporters. This from a Republican, African-American Republican, former vice chair of the party who resigned recently in protest. Quite a different view from that General Powell gave from the podium last night.
That's right, Juan. And we are going to hear from General Colin Powell on the podium last night. But first, well, the theme of the first night of the Republican convention was No Children Left Behind. Ironically, it was a kind of Gulf War reunion with Colin Powell on the stage and former Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney and former President George Bush. Ironic because it was that triumvirate, along with General Norman Schwarzkopf, that presided over the Gulf War, which began with bombs and continues through this day with economic sanctions that have killed an estimated 500,000 children in Iraq. The U.S. and British bombing of Iraq continues on an almost daily basis. Well, last night, Democracy Now! Producer Jeremy Scahill and I almost made it to the floor and happened to be at the entrance to the stadium when former President Bush and his wife Barbara made their way to their skybox. As he walked up to the stairs of the box, I asked him what he says to people who say he's a war criminal for the bombing of Iraq. I think they're idiots, he said. Well, a couple of hours later, I had a chance to question him again. We'll go to that tape.
I never heard anybody say something stupid.
What is your response?
Something stupid like that.
We're going to go to that tape of that question right now.
I didn't hear what you said. What did you say to those who say that you're a war criminal for the bombing of Iraq?
I never heard anybody ever say that before.
What's your response?
I say we defeated in the sands a guy that invaded another country, brutalized his own people. I mean, come on. I never heard anybody say something stupid.
What is your response?
Something stupid like that.
And that was former President George Bush speaking last night as he came off of the stage. Well, we're going to talk about General Colin Powell right now, the 12th chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the Department of Defense from 1989 to 1993, under both President George Bush and President Bill Clinton. In this capacity, he served as the principal military advisor to the president, the Secretary of Defense, and the National Security Council during the Gulf War. As a deputy operations officer in the U.S. Army in the Vietnam War, Colin Powell drafted the first official response denying rumors that up to 400 Vietnamese civilians died at the hands of U.S. soldiers in My Lai on March 16, 1968. Senior officers who were in Vietnam at the time are quietly skeptical of his account, whom they say must have known about the massacre. As Caspar Weinberger's military assistant, Powell was in the loop on the Reagan administration's secret plan to supply Hawk and TOW missiles to Iran. Yesterday, Colin Powell took the stage as he talked about U.S. foreign policy as well as domestic policy. This is an excerpt of what he had to say.
I've seen kids destroying themselves with drugs. Kids who see violence and crime as the answer to their hopelessness. Kids who no longer believe in themselves and who don't see a reason to believe in America. I've seen kids in utter despair. I've visited kids in jail doing adult time for the crimes they've committed. They are part of a growing population of over 2 million Americans behind bars. 2 million convicts, not consumers. 2 million Americans who, while paying for their crimes, are not paying taxes, are not there for their children, and are not raising families. Most of them are men, and the majority of those men are minorities. We either get back to the task of building our children the way we know how, or we're going to keep building jails in America, and it's time to stop building jails in America and get back to the task of building our children. For the first time in almost a century, America does not face an enemy fueled by an ideology claiming to be superior to our beloved system of democracy, free enterprise, and the rights of men and women to pursue their individual destinies. We defeated communism. We defeated fascism. We defeated them on the field of battle, and we defeated them on the field of ideas. The sick nations that still pursue the fool's gold of tyranny and weapons of mass destruction will soon find themselves left behind in the dustbin of history. They are investing in their own demise as surely as the Soviet Union did by investing in the Red Army. They are of the past, and we are of the future. Count on it. Today, we are the most powerful nation on earth, militarily, economically, by any measure. We are that rarity in history, a trusted nation whose power is tempered by compassion, whose leadership is earned by example, and whose foreign affairs will be guided by common interest and common sense. The world is watching to see if all this power and wealth is just for the well-to-do, the comfortable, the privileged, or are we a nation that can make our dream real for all Americans? He will not repeat the mistakes of the past and let our insurance policy, our armed forces, fall into disrepair.
General Colin Powell speaking last night on the convention floor, the first night of the Republican National Convention. He spoke after Laura Bush, and you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now. Juan?
An amazing speech, especially the reference to the 2 million people in jail, and clearly Colin Powell, in his manner, in his own way, was trying to appeal to the better sense of the Republicans, but the only way he could figure out how to do it was to mention that there were 2 million convicts, not 2 million consumers, that the Republicans, and that idea of 2 million lost consumers, I guess, was his way of trying to appeal to the Republicans to take an interest in the prison population of America. Astounding.
Well, we have some interesting commentary coming up. We're joined now by Dave McReynolds. He's there joining the protests in the streets, but he is also the Socialist Party candidate for president. Welcome to Democracy Now.
Glad to be here.
Can you respond to General Powell?
Well, I think there are two things I'd say quickly. One of them is he talked about access to health care for all young people. And he didn't make it clear, number one, whether only young people should have access to health care, and number two, he didn't make it clear whether the access meant health care or simply access. So I think I would catch him up there. But the most important thing he said, the greatest obvious contradiction, was when he talked about the Soviet Union having spent itself into bankruptcy with the Red Army and then proceeded to call for a renewed investment in American military power, even as he had pointed out that we don't have any enemies. And I think this is one of the ongoing problems of the corporate military complex that Eisenhower, himself a Republican, had warned about. And it's one of the hidden cards that neither Gore nor Bush are going to tackle, is the military-industrial complex. And he laid it right out there. And the problem for us is you're not going to deal with those 2 million people in prison. You're not going to deal with education. You're not going to deal with health care if you're spending $60 billion on the Star Wars program and a military budget of over $300 billion a year. And this is craziness. So that's a contradiction that I think the press will not pick up on, because that's sort of an exempt topic.
And, of course, last night was only the prelude to even more attention that will be devoted to the military preparedness of the country, or lack of military preparedness, that will be the theme tonight as the Republican convention seeks to reach out to that military constituency, families and retired military people, to line up behind George Bush's presidency. But we're also joined by Father Roy Bourgeois, who has been confronting that military machine now for years, and who was involved yesterday in some of the activities around the School of the Americas. Welcome. You've been here by voice many times in the past, and now you're here both on voice and on community television.
Good to be with you.
Could you tell us about what happened yesterday?
Yes. First, let me say, it was very difficult to hear the words last night of General Powell talking about his traveling throughout the country and being moved by the poverty that he saw and those struggling to survive. And it's about caring for people. Well, I thought back to his visit in the 1980s when he went to El Salvador, where there we were pumping $1 million a day into this country to a government at war with its people, many of those soldiers doing the killing trained at the U.S. Army School of the Americas that led us to this action yesterday that we'll talk about. But there he was in El Salvador. I'll never forget the images of the photographs and seeing that on television. He is going to El Salvador during the height of the death squads, right after the assassination of Archbishop Oscar Romero, gunned down in church by soldiers in El Salvador for his defense of the poor. Also, it was shortly after the rape and murder of four U.S. churchwomen, two of them Marino sisters of my Marino community. But here was General Powell in El Salvador, shaking hands with the generals there, congratulating them, supporting them on their good work. And I thought about that, and it made me angry, it made me sad. But this is what brings us to Philadelphia.
Well, we're going to talk about what you did in Philadelphia yesterday, along with a number of other people, including a 17-year-old high school student who got arrested protesting the School of the Americas. When we come back from our break, our guest, Father Roy Bourgeois, and the Socialist Party candidate for president, Dave McReynolds. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Breaking with Convention, Power, Protest, and the Presidency, broadcasting live from the Independent Media Center in downtown Philadelphia at the Republican National Convention. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Breaking with Convention, Power, Protest, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez, and we're in the Independent Media Center, where hundreds of video activists and journalists, chroniclers of what's happening here, people with tape recorders, people with simply pens and paper or just their eyes and ears, are walking outside. They are observing what is taking place, and they are coming back. They are putting it on the web at www.indymedia.org. We saw the IMC in full blossom in Seattle at the protests of the World Trade Organization, moving on to Washington in April at the protests of the World Bank and the IMF, and now we are situated here on Locust and 13th, which is an area in downtown Philadelphia that is really in the center, in fact, the center city. And today, in this segment, we are talking about Colin Powell, who took center stage last night. The general addressed the first night of the Republican National Convention. Our guests, I believe slightly different from what the corporate media had on last night, our guests are the socialist candidate for president, Dave McReynolds, as well as Father Roy Bourgeois, just hours before General Colin Powell gave his speech. Father Roy Bourgeois, where did you and a group of people of conscience head in Philadelphia?
We were downtown in front of City Hall, Market Street. We were there, a large group of us, members of the School of the Americas Watch movement, made up of thousands around the country, trying to close down a military school at Fort Benning, Georgia, that trains every year hundreds of soldiers from Latin American combat. And many of these soldiers have returned to their home countries, and they have killed, they have tortured, they have raped. And we are here in Philadelphia to bring a very clear and strong message to the Republicans and later to the Democrats that we want this school of assassins shut down, all paid for with our tax money to the tune of about $20 million a year, saying to them that that money should be used in the inner city here in Philadelphia for schools, for health care. And so we went downtown Philadelphia And there was a mock in Allison, will be able to, our high school student, Allison Stein, will tell us of the, you know, she was part of the nine, a member of the nine, arrested yesterday, but it was a mock massacre with Uncle Sam and the soldiers, really trying to express what's going on in Latin America through what happened yesterday, calling attention to the intense suffering and pain of those in Latin America.
Allison, could you tell us about why you came here and what happened yesterday?
Well, the reason I came here is because the School of the Americas is definitely a cause that deserves so much more attention than it's getting, and so many more people need to become aware of this. This is a cause that directly involves anyone living in the United States who's paying taxes.
Where do you live?
I'm sorry?
Where do you live?
I live in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania.
And how did you first hear about School of the Americas?
I was down in Nicaragua two summers ago to learn about the foreign debt and how it affects the people. And this is another issue that affects the Latin American people. These issues are all so intertwined because it's part of globalization, economic, and military.
You're saying two summers ago. Now you're 17 now?
I'm 17,
So
yes.
You were 15 when you went down there. Why did you go down?
I found out about it through my church, and I had been looking for some way to get involved in working towards justice, and that kind of seemed a good route to go. And I have since traveled to Chiapas, Mexico, where I recently returned from, to learn more about the School of the Americas. And so it's that connection, I think, that personal connection with the Latin American people and just seeing face-to-face their struggle that really, I think, pushes me and pushes a lot of people to
Allison,
work for change.
What did you do yesterday?
How
did you get arrested?
Father Roy said we began on the sidewalk. We were reenacting a massacre. There were soldiers involved in spraying people with red paint, symbolic of the blood that shed by the Latin Americans.
Mock soldiers.
Yes, mock soldiers, of which I was one of. We later proceeded to move the bodies out into the intersection in order just to make this action seen by as many people as possible, to reach as many people as possible, and just to raise the most possible awareness that we could of our cause. Eventually, the police arrived and we were asked to leave, which we would not do because we're dedicated to our cause. We're not willing to sit on the sidewalk while atrocities are taking place in other countries. We will stay and we will sit and we will make our witness as long as we are able until we're forcibly removed, which at some point we were and taken away.
What's been the reaction of your friends in your hometown in Pennsylvania to your activities? Well, many of them are involved with MTV or Survivor or a lot of the other consumer fads that young people are dragged into. How do they react to your activism?
My friends have actually become very involved in the work that I'm doing just because I think they realize how important it is to me and how much it touches me when I come back from trips and tell them about it and just cry with them and talk to them. They've been very receptive to that. And I think also that it touches them, and we've actually had a very growing movement in my town recently. It's just a spreading of awareness. You know, one person tells another person, and that person passes it along to another, and it just continues and continues to grow.
Allison Stein, 17 years old, got out of jail last night, came to the studios here at the Independent Media Center in Philadelphia to talk. After General Colin Powell took the stage last night. We're also joined on the telephone by Mark Crispin Miller. He is writing a book on the Gulf War and also has done a critique of General Colin Powell's autobiography. We're going to see if through the miracle of phone lines in this very low-tech and yet high-tech at the same time place, we can hear Mark Crispin Miller speaking to us from New York University in New York. Welcome to Democracy Now, Mark.
Hi, Amy. Hi, Juan.
Beautiful. So, tell us a little about General Colin Powell.
Well, General Powell is a very smooth article, as you no doubt have noticed. This is a guy who has risen to the top meteorically from the time of his very impressive military service, militarily impressive, up through his years of apprenticeship during the Reagan presidency. He was an assistant to Frank Carlucci, who was himself an assistant to Caspar Weinberger, and then moved up to become Weinberger's military assistant. And it was during that time that he was, as you pointed out a moment ago, involved tangentially in Iran-Contra, although he was never questioned. And one of the reasons why he was never questioned was that the committee was uneasy about appearing to be beating up on such an impressive figure and a military man to boot. It was after that that he served directly as National Security Advisor for Ronald Reagan, although there's no evidence that Reagan actually ever knew who he was, which is not Powell's fault, obviously. And then, you know, the rest is unfortunately history, because he became chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff under President Bush. And it was in that capacity that he brought all of his considerable strategic and tactical skills to bear on the great mission of faking out the American people. What I mean by that is that the team that brought us Operation Desert Storm actually, I would argue, paid more attention to the way that the spectacle would play for the TV audience in the United States than they did to the military operation itself. It was a real masterpiece of propaganda meant to exalt the military, put the so-called Vietnam Syndrome behind us, and I think not least, provide a great showcase for American military hardware. So it's therefore no coincidence that you know, during the same event where the Bushes and Cheney and Powell are starring, you've got the major defense contractors showing their wares right near the convention hall, thanks to the offices of the Pentagon. So you mentioned Colin Powell's autobiography. He's an extraordinarily popular figure. And I think some of this has to do with his own demeanor, his bearing, his own personal charisma. He is obviously a riveting character, and I would say he was the only speaker last night who had any kind of flair on stage. A lot of this has to do with how neatly his own story fits into the classic mold of the self-made man, rags to riches. He's a Horatio Alger figure for the turn of this new century. His book is called My American Journey. And on the cover, it says the life story of a young boy from the Bronx who grew up to live the American dream. So you know immediately that we're dealing with myth rather than with reality, because in fact, Colin Powell owed his rise not only to his own talents, but to his really extraordinary political abilities. This is a guy who, you know, brushed very closely up against some of the worst events of the second half of the 20th century. You mentioned My Lai, yet he emerged from that whole episode completely unscathed. Iran-Contra, the same way. The invasion of Panama, the same thing. It was actually an atrocious and dubious and probably illegal action. He was involved with it, but somehow he's retained his Teflon, you know. And then the Gulf War also was and is an extraordinary propaganda masterpiece. And Colin Powell kept the myth alive with his book, which, you know, I don't recommend that anybody read it cover to cover, but if you take a look at Chapter 19, which describes the first night of the war, you find a bald-faced reconfirmation of claims about American military performance that have long since been disproved and that were known to be false at the time he wrote the book. For example, he celebrates how well the stealth fighter did the first night of the war, that the stealths entered Iraqi airspace like ghosts, he writes. Well, this is simply false. You know, if you go to the Center for Defense Information in D.C. and you read their thick dossier of clippings on the actual performance of the stealth, you discover that for all of its stealthiness, British warships could pick it up from the Gulf as it flew into Iraqi airspace. So it wasn't terribly stealthy. But more important, it could not enter Iraqi airspace until a broad range of different kinds of aircraft, much cheaper aircraft, had first destroyed Iraqi anti-aircraft emplacements. So it couldn't do its job until cheaper technology had been used to clear the path for it. But in General Powell's book, the stealth did just as brilliantly as its sponsors claim that it did. The same is the case with the Patriot missile, which is a well-known failure. In the pages of My American Journey, it did spectacularly well. The same is the case with the disastrous Scud hunt, which actually prolonged the war. Allied forces remained incapable of destroying a single mobile Scud launcher throughout the whole war. And yet, in the book My American Journey...
Mark, if I can interrupt you for one second, I just would like to ask you, given this enormous involvement of Colin Powell, obviously as a general in the American war machine, if you could tell us briefly, how you see his emergence now as sort of like the social conscience of the Republican Party? He's in essence, now the moderate, representing the only moderate in the Republican Party who gets to regularly now speak at conventions.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. I was asking myself that same question last night because I was, as I think you were, Juan, kind of taken aback by the bluntness with which he, you know, made some of those points about, you know, say, affirmative action, you know, and saying it has to be the same for corporations. I think that he, you know, has the ability to do this because his vision is still fundamentally a conservative vision. On issues of race, it is not. And let's say on issues of race, it is it's a far more inclusive vision than the vision of the, you know, White Citizens Council, for example. But on issues of military power and of economic justice, his vision is solidly conservative. His ideal for the society is a military ideal, or I should say a militaristic ideal. He was, understandably, and remains terribly grateful to the military establishment for the advantages that it gave him in life. It is a more integrated system than the civilian sector that surrounds it.
Mark Crispin Miller is a media analyst at New York University. He's writing a book on the Gulf War. Dave McReynolds, we went through the life history of General Colin Powell. Talk a little about your activism over the years. How old are you, by the way, socialist candidate for president?
70 years old. If elected, I'd be older than Reagan when he went in. So it's lucky I won't be elected.
So let's talk about alternative paths.
Well, you know, I'm looking at Powell. I don't want to discuss the personality. He's an attractive personality, but I want to examine what I would call the driving forces of the Republican Party and of the Democratic Party. Both those conventions will be marvelous conventions, but well-staged and attractive. But at what point do we realize that the real forces behind both conventions are a corporate state, and that we do not yet have any real way of coping with the corporate rule that we're facing in this country? We just heard some of the stuff around Colin Powell's background, and the same thing I think is going to be true of the Democratic Convention, that Al Gore will be seen as an essential savior of the Republic. But we're stuck with a corporate state that we don't know how to deal with.
We're going to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, a quick history of your life and your activism to talk about alternative histories, because it seems these days if you don't have a military credential by your name, you are not a significant or contributing member of political society in this country. Dave McReynolds is the Socialist Party candidate for president. We've been joined by Father Roy Bourgeois, the School of the Americas Watch, SOA Watch, which had a major protest in Philadelphia yesterday with 9 people arrested, and Allison Stein, one of those people arrested as well, a 17-year-old student from Pennsylvania. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute here live from Philadelphia. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, as we bring you alternative views and commentary on last night's opening night at the Republican National Convention with Colin Powell, General Colin Powell, who followed Laura Bush in speaking to the convention floor and the nation on some channels. Our guest right now, socialist candidate for president, Dave McReynolds. A quick thumbnail sketch of your history of activism, Dave McReynolds.
All right, Amy, I joined the Socialist Party at UCLA in 1951. I joined the War Resisters League about the same time. I was arrested for refusing induction during the Korean War, not the Vietnam War. Won that case on a technicality, went to work for Liberation Magazine in 1957 under A.J. Mustey and Bayard Rustin, Dave Dellinger, Roy Finch, Sid Lenz, and went on the staff of the War Resisters League in 1960 and worked for that until January of 1999, when I retired, and am now running as a Socialist Party's candidate. My history, I'm afraid, does not include any dramatic military service, but a number of arrests over the years, and in the course of the Vietnam War, a visit to Hanoi and Saigon, and the course of the Gulf War, a visit to Iraq shortly before the main assault there, and other visits to other parts of the world, the Soviet Union during the period when it was about to break up. I was in Prague by sheer good luck during the invasion. You don't often get a chance to be there during that kind of thing. So that's the summation of my history.
Well, Dave, how do you respond to those who would say that your quest for the presidency is even more quixotic and and irrelevant than Ralph Nader's or Pat Buchanan's? What do you hope to gain by running?
Yeah, let me add one thing to that record so I'm not accused of avoiding it. I came out as a homosexual in 1969, so I think that was one of the first open statements. Look, the presidential election is a referendum on ideas. That's really all it is. So I'm trying to present the concept of socialism, put it back in the American dialogue. I think it has a right to be in. I'm tired of hearing we're anti-imperialist, anti-racist, and so on, and not know what we're for. And I am for democratic socialism, an idea as old as 1901 when the party was founded. It goes back to the last century. It's not rooted in Moscow or Lenin. That's all I can hope to accomplish. That and hitting some of the issues which we hear all of us here know about, including the School of the Americas, including the prison situation, including medical care, a whole host of things, the drug war. The insanity, when Powell talked about the drug war, the insanity of having the one drug which has no recorded deaths to it, marijuana, is criminal, and the two drugs that are legal have lethal impacts, alcohol and tobacco. That's all I can hope to accomplish. The real struggle is at the congressional level, at the legislative level, and it's in the streets. I don't think people really are aware. Many of those who are backing Nader, for example, I don't think are aware of the power of the structure they oppose and the cost it will take to change that structure. If you look at any really serious social change, from India under Gandhi, which I take as my example and my methodology, there were large numbers of people killed and there were massive arrests, and Gandhi spent a large part of his adult life in British prisons. If you look at the Southern movement, you're looking at a trail of blood and horror, and children killed in their schools and beatings and brutality that only if you were in the South during that time can you understand the slogan that said that many atheists went to the South but none returned as atheists because of the impact of the Black Baptist Church. But those struggles were not won in the courts. They were not run simply by votes. That was part of a dialectical thing, but they were won in the streets. And I think the Socialist Party's job is to try to win people to a path of peaceful but profound and radical social change.
Will you be suing to be included in the debates?
No, Amy, not, because the fact is we could not win the election if we carried all of the 10 states where we hope to be on the ballot, and therefore I don't think we have the same right to be in the debates. I have to be clear about that. But I would argue very strongly the Libertarian Party, which is on the ballot in all 50 states, has an equal right with Ralph Nader or with Buchanan. And the debates should be open to every party that is on the ballot in enough states that if it carried them, it could win. And Nader certainly should be included, Buchanan, the Libertarians. There should be another level of debates for those of us from the minor parties where we can really get involved in a discussion of ideas. But no, we're not going to sue for that particular arena.
What does it mean to run for president?
So far, it means 20 states that I know of that I've been traveling through since being nominated last October. It means probably a lot more work for my campaign manager, Sean Richmond, who's 50 years younger than I am. For me, it means primarily traveling and talking to audiences and, in some cases, as yesterday, being out in the street and the day before with the demonstrators. I had thought we were all going to be arrested yesterday, so I had carefully left my catnip back in the hotel. Because I carry catnip in case you meet a stray cat. I had a feeling if I got arrested, I would be in trouble with the authorities confusing the catnip for something else.
Well, I thought it would be interesting to bring into this discussion some young activists as well, as you all take to the streets here in Philadelphia. Dave McReynolds is with us. He is the Socialist Party candidate for president. And we're joined by Peter Chung and Jiaqing Chen. Peter Chung is an organizer with SLAM, and you can say what that is an acronym for. Jiaqing Chen is an organizer with Just Act, that's Youth Action for Global Justice, as well as the Ruckus Society. Peter Chung, what is SLAM?
SLAM is a student liberation action movement at Hunter College based in New York City. We've been working around educational access issues, also police violence, prisons, and political prisoners, and we thought it was really important to bring these issues to the Republican National Convention.
And what have you been doing?
Oh, lots and lots and lots of hard work. The main thing that SLAM as an organization has been doing here at the Republican National Convention is try to bring more people of color to be a part of the protests and to make them feel comfortable within the spaces that have been created out of Seattle and D.C. What we realized is that people of color and the organizations that they represent or are represented by have been doing lots of work in the local grassroots communities for many, many years, and that the explosion of the types of protests coming out of Seattle and D.C., there needed to be a way to unite these two forces. And so we saw the Republican National Convention as the perfect opportunity to not only highlight the issues of the criminal injustice system that we've been working on, but also try to unite different issues and bring people of color doing direct action.
And what are you hoping to accomplish here?
Just Act's mission is very similar explicitly to what Peter was just speaking about in terms of bringing unity to the movement between the kind of disparate pieces that are seen coming out of Seattle, out of D.C., out of these demonstrations and out of different types of grassroots organizing that happen around the country. Just Act's mission is to bring traditionally marginalized communities to issues of globalization, to activism on the global economy, specifically focusing on youth of color and working class youth. So we've been working with a number of the organizations that have done a lot of the groundwork here in Philadelphia. And while we haven't been lead organizers here, members of our national network who participated in youth of color contingents in both Seattle and D.C. have really taken the lead in addressing the kind of hurdles to democracy within the movement that reflect the struggles that we're engaged in against the system.
Jia Qingsheng, can you talk about how things are set up here in terms of the protest? There is the Independent Media Center that is here on Locust Center City. Then there are other convergence centers. What is a convergence center?
Well, the convergence centers, the idea started in Seattle, where the idea was that for this national mobilization, we would be able to create spaces that facilitated the people coming from all over the country getting plugged into the different types of work, like from building puppets to doing different types of trainings, preparing people for the demonstrations, preparing people to protect one another from police violence, to understand how the legal system works for civil disobedience, etc. I think Peter can speak to the different convergences that have been organized here.
The convergence sites, actually, one of the major differences that has happened here in Philly that didn't happen in Seattle and D.C. is that we try to create a space on a convergence site specifically for people of color to address the specific needs of people of color. And so, I mean, it was really exciting for us because there is an understanding that people of color have different issues that must be addressed and emphasized more when doing direct action. And so it was really exciting to create this safe space, but also that this convergence site that was utilized for people of color would be plugged in with the main convergence sites for the rest of the people organizing, so that there wasn't this, like, we are organizing in a bubble type atmosphere, but that we are organizing together with an understanding that people of color have some special needs that need to be addressed, and so we should create the space.
What are some of those special needs, given the fact that, of course, it, as you mentioned, in Seattle, the protesters were largely white, and why did you? What are the particular needs that you have that would necessitate, in essence, a creation of a separate convergence center?
I believe there are actually some, you know, specific practical needs if you look at our society, namely sort of the way the police will react to us compared to other protesters. I mean, if you look at our society, the people that are the victims of police violence are usually people of color. And that's no different when you go to a protest. It's no different when you are in the setting of protesting. So it's, we understand that by doing direct action, we actually place our bodies on the line more than white protesters do because of the way the state and the police can actually do physical violence to us. And also the psychological violence of people of color going through the system, I believe is slightly different because of sort of the oppression, the historical oppression that has been on us. And so we have to deal with these issues, we have to dialogue with these issues, and it's difficult to do that within a space that is, you know, so short on time that we have to get through just the regular legal understandings, which are extensive in itself. But also to deal with these issues, we thought it was vitally important to create this space.
Peter, why do you think there are so few people of color involved in the protests? There seem to be a growing number, but overall, the face is largely a white one.
I want to slightly disagree with that, especially here in Philly, because we have done, a magnificent job organizing a large contingent of people of color to come down here and specifically engage in direct action. But, I mean, I hear what you're saying, and, I mean, one of the reasons I truly believe is distrust, how in the movement there has been a splinter and now there is this distrust, and how do we actually mend these sort of these feelings of distrust and disunity, how do we actually start struggling together and unify? And I think me organizing here in Philly, trying to bridge this gap, trying to heal some of the distrust that I have built up in myself, and I think a lot of other people of color have built up in themselves, has been a really interesting and growing process. And I hope, I'm hoping to go out to Los Angeles for the Democratic National Convention, and I hope Jia Qing for Just Act is doing some of the organizing for the Democratic National Convention, and I hope we can talk about the different ways we used here, what we can do differently, and sort of how do we bridge this gap of distrust. And it's a difficult question. I don't have the answers for it.
Judge Chang, in Seattle, the corporate press attempted to focus most of its attention on the few incidents of window breaking that occurred rather than on this massive display of civil disobedience by people from all around the country against corporate globalization and what the WTO represented. How are you hoping to get your message across at this convention so that you can avoid some of that if you can in terms of the way the corporate media portray you?
Well, I think a lot of the issues that people are addressing have definitely kind of facilitated that. A lot of the demonstrations, the demonstration organizers are rooted here in Philadelphia, has helped a lot. I mean, if we look at Kensington Welfare Rights Union, Sherry Honkla, she has, you know, a long-standing tradition of civil disobedience here in town and knows all the police. And, you know, there were threats of using police violence, of there being no tolerance, quote unquote, for civil disobedience or the blocking of traffic or, you know, marching down Broad Street. But, you know, really, it's kind of interesting. The police here in Philly over the last week or so have changed their rhetoric from that of a very intimidating stance to one of, you know, Mr. Nice Guy. And I think, in a way, they're trying to kind of take out that pressure that has kind of escalated the stories and has driven the stories. And I think we have a unique opportunity here in Philly to get our messages out.
One thing I noticed in these demonstrations, that unlike Seattle, where you basically had all the police decked out in riot gear and in a confrontational mode, the Philadelphia mm-hmm. Police Department has gone to extensively using, as they've always had a history of using, the Civilian Affairs Unit, basically a lot of plainclothes policemen that are in the crowds, and a sort of reduced focus on the visible presence of large groups of police to sort of provoke confrontation. Have you noticed that much in the protest so far?
I did march with the Kensington Welfare Rights Union for a little while, and I saw these plainclothes police, and they were just marching alongside, you know, and very, very visibly they were, you know, they're clearly police officers. They're clearly, not only do they wear identifiers on their arms, but just their way they separate themselves from the demonstrators is definitely there for the purpose of regulating the rest of the people.
I want to end with Dave McReynolds. We only have about 30 seconds. Dave McReynolds, Socialist Party candidate for president, as you look at these young people, listen to what they have to say, your years of activism going back 40 years, do you see a difference in the organizing of today?
Not so much of a difference as I do a continuity and a revival of something which is from the 60s and from the 30s. And I hope that they will keep in mind, as I know that many of them will, that behind the rhetoric that you hear from the Republican Party are the many millions who've died in East Timor, in Cuba, in Central America, in Vietnam, in the Gulf War, as a result of American policy. And that the reality behind the national conventions is the fact that we have tens of millions of Americans who are living in poverty, and that's not going to be on television.
Finally, Peter Chung.
I just wanted to once again say that we should focus on the issues around the criminal justice system for today, August 1st. The demands that we are asking for today are free Mumia Abu-Jamal and all political prisoners, abolish the prison industrial complex, abolish the death penalty, stop police violence, end the corporate war on the poor, and power to our community.
I want to thank you all for being with us, Peter Chung, Jiaqing Chen, and David McReynolds. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Broadcast from the Independent Media Center in Philadelphia, produced by Jeremy Scahill, with help from Deepa Fernandez, Karen Palmer, and John Hamilton, our technical director, Grayson Challenger, assistance from Sanaz Mazafarian, David Thompson, Lissa Scholl, Nell Geiser, video production by Didi Halleck and crew, Prothop Chatterjee, our new media reporter. From the studios of the Independent Media Center, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!